Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
There are over 100 historically black colleges and universities in America, and many are struggling to meet the challenges of the 21st century. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Historically black colleges and universities were the creation of the post-Civil War era when southern states refused to integrate. In the years since, they've become key institutions in the African-American community for higher learning and social mobility. But with the Civil Rights era, the once predominantly white universities and colleges began to draw away many African-American students. So what is the role of historically black colleges and universities as we embark on the first decades of the 21st century? In studio with us is Dr. Anthony Jenkins. He's Vice President of Student Affairs and Enrollment Management at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you see as the, let's just sort of grow back to the origin of the historically black colleges and universities, and tell us a little bit about how they came about and what is, and what was their impetus? How do they, because they seem to, they were clearly became part of, a key part of the African-American community in that post-slavery, that post-Reconstruction era.
Correct. Yeah, Don, you had touched on, I think, at the in your opening that the post-Civil War era was very critical for historically black institutions. And these institutions served as catalysts to educate slaves. And over time, that role has become more significant. They initially started out as really focusing on preparing individuals to become teachers. And you had some institutions in the South, such as Tuskegee and some others, that were focusing on science, medicine, those academic areas. And as they have evolved over time, that role within the African-American community has gotten stronger. And when you look at UMES, for instance, we were established in 1886. We started with one building, one teacher, and nine students. And so over the last 127 years, the university has grown tremendously. We are now over 4,000 students. The physical landscape of the campus sits on just over 1,000 acres. We have over 200 full-time faculty. The campus, from a physical standpoint, is one of the best you're going to find nationally. In fact, several years ago, we were voted the second most beautiful campus in the nation. But the role that we continue to play is a very critical role. And so not only within Princess Anne, but in the state of Maryland and nationally.
Well, one of the things I alluded to, and I found it really interesting as I've particularly as I've been here on this shore, is that when the Civil Rights era came, mm-hmm. and you got integration, the desegregation ends, one of the things that you get is a number of institutions within the African American community then begin to dissolve. For instance, I know a few years ago, I was talking to some folks about how they wanted to bring football back to UMES. And I remember talking to some of the football players who played during that period when there was segregation. And these were like powerhouses. And one of the things that struck them was not the only reason why it disappeared from UMES, but one of the things that struck some of the players was that as integration took place, these great Black players no longer had to go to, say, for instance, a Black university or Black college. They could go somewhere else. So it seems as if that moment in which you had integration, on the one hand, everybody says, yes, we had to do this,
right?
On the other hand, it had these unintended consequences.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. No. And I think when you look at it from that perspective, I think one of the hardest hit areas for historically Black institutions was athletics. When you look at UMES, yes, back in the 60s and the 70s, we were a football powerhouse. Greats like Art Shell, these individuals went on to have outstanding NFL careers and now are NFL Hall of Famers. But when you also look at it from an academic standpoint, if you go back to 1990, nationally, there were roughly 250,000 African American students who attended historically Black colleges and universities. If you move forward 10 years from 1990 to 2000, that number grew to over 275,000. If you move forward another 10 years to 2010, 2011, that number is well over 370,000 students. So the enrollment trends for African American students at historically Black institutions has climbed over the last 20 plus years. That's not to include the more diverse population that these institutions are attracting every day.
Well, one of the things that struck me is that there are a lot of African Americans now who can go to white institutions.
Right.
What you seem to be saying, what do you attribute this increase to? I mean, because on the one hand, you've got the drain going out. That's mm-hmm. very clear. On the other mm-hmm. hand, you're seeing an influx. Is it just that more and more African Americans are now going to college? Is that part of the key?
Well, it is. You know, over the last two decades or so, we've seen more first generation college students enter higher mm-hmm. education. And when you look at the landscape, the actual demographic factors of students who are graduating from high school in the United States, if you look at where we are now and you project out over the next 20 years, you will see that there is minimal growth with African-American students. White students are pretty much flattening over the next decade. And, of course, the largest growth is in the Hispanic areas. So what we have seen is that that first generation influx has really had an impact on HBIs. In the state of Maryland, if we look at that state only, first generation students entering higher education will do so through two facets, either a historically Black institution or a community college. And that trend has held in the state of Maryland for the last 20 years or more.
As a matter of fact, I was looking at some stats, and some of the stats, for instance, in science and technology, for instance, 18% of all Black engineers come through HBCUs, or 31% of Black biologists, nearly 25% of African Americans with degrees in, say, management, mm-hmm. they come through that. Let me ask you this. Do you see a difference in in the courses that are being taught in a historically Black college as opposed to, say, the predominantly traditional white colleges? Is there an academic difference here?
No.
And what's taught? I mean, you know what I mean?
Right. You know, the actual basic fundamentals of what is taught in science and mathematics, no. But I think what has been proven to be the major difference is that many students, first-generation African-American, first-generation white students, first-generation Latino students, The HBCU curriculum and the environment is an experience as opposed to a process that you find at many other institutions. It is that type of nurturing, that type of high expectations that you can achieve and that we are expecting you to. And the actual curriculum is more hands-on, more intimate, which really has been proven throughout research to be a significant factor in how well students learn and how well they retain information, and the application component that is so prevalent at so many HBIs. I think those are some very significant factors that contribute to some of the actual stats you just talked about. I would even go as far as to, you know, say it's important to understand that when you look at the landscape of higher education, HBIs make up less than 3% of the four-year colleges and universities in the United States. Less than 3%. However, they lead the nation in producing the most African American with undergraduate degrees in areas such as psychology, science, mathematics, engineering, education. When you look at education, again, let's focus on our state for one quick moment. At UMES, we have students who pass the Praxis 1 and Praxis 2, which is a state test that students must pass before they can go on to their teacher's licensures and so forth, at 100%. That tops Johns Hopkins, Towson, Bowie, Salisbury. These are the type of things that are happening at HBIs that we are still having, I think, some very interesting conversations about, and trying to move individuals away from some of the myths about the quality of education at HBIs and focusing on the facts that they are leading the nation and producing top African American graduates. If I could add one more thing quickly, Xavier University in New Orleans every year produces more successful African American medical school applicants than Harvard, Johns Hopkins, and the University of Maryland at College Park combined. And so the quality of the education should not be challenged in this day and age. HBIs have, for the most part, created the African American professional middle class that we know today. And they continue to be the cornerstone of higher education nationally. And so I think that one of the things we do as educators and as citizens is we do ourselves a disservice when we talk about our higher education system in two tiers. We talk about predominantly white institutions and we talk about historically black institutions. And yet we all are in this same game together, making sure that we produce individuals who add to an educated citizenry and can help return the United States to the education powerhouse it once was.
When I was looking around and looking and reading about some of the various historically black colleges, mm-hmm. one of the things that a recurring theme was trying to attract students.
Yes.
And that there was in some institutions there was a decline. And one of the suggestions that you're competing in essence with other predominantly with predominantly white mm-hmm. colleges, as well as obviously other African American colleges. What about that competition for students? I mean, in fact, it was, I think it was in Mississippi, I think it was, there was a black college down there, and one of the officials there said, well, what we like to think of ourselves as a regional rather than simply just a historically black college, that we're trying to attract people because we're competing from, you know, with Jackson State and so on,
right.
Mississippi and so on. How, do you see yourself in the same vein as what is the... Have you seen a decline, by the way, in your enrollment? I don't know whether you have or not, but other institutions have. What about that competition with trying to attract
right.
that African American student to your institution, as opposed to say going to say USC, for example?
Right. No, that's an excellent question. Yes, we are competing with not only other HBIs, but we're competing with, you know, outstanding schools like, you know, Salisbury and College Park and Towson and so forth. We have a very rich educational foundation here in the state of Maryland. But what we are seeing is that students continue to be interested in UMES. Our application pool has continued to increase. We are seeing a more diverse student population. Right now, about 31% of the students at UMES self-identify as something other than African American. And so what we are now seeing is that when you look at let's take white students, for instance, who are attending UMES, they outnumber the African American students who are attending institutions like Salisbury and Frostburg and so on and so forth. So we are competing. It is important that we continue to display our outstanding programs, our business school, the accreditation that our business school has puts it in the top 10% in the entire country. Our engineering program, our hotel restaurant management program, our PGM program. We are only one of 19 institutions in the country that has a PGA golf management program, but the only historically black institution. I think that the quality of our education and the unique programs that we have allows us to compete with some of our competitors, sister institutions also. I think that those unique programs are attracting more than just African American students because our student population has diversified over the last 10 to 15 years. But what we have also seen is that students are self-selecting UMES. And so to your point, students and parents are selecting UMES as opposed to Stanford or some other institution for the same reasons that they select any school. There is some niche. There is some value. There is something that they see in that institution that they believe can prepare their son or daughter to compete and be successful in a global society. Every university has this, you know, niche. We, I think, have a very good niche. Salisbury has one, Towson, College Park, Bowie. So students are going to self-select according to their personal criteria. What we want to do is just continue to make sure that our nationally ranked academic programs and our nationally ranked faculty continue to provide the quality education that parents and students are looking for, and we'll let everything else take care of itself.
In fact, I was noticing, I think it was in 1950, historically black colleges, enrollment in the institutions were 100% African American. Mm-hmm. Today, it tracks somewhat with what you're talking about. It's something like 61%.
That's right.
Are actually, so you see, you do have this growth. But let me ask you, because one of the things that I've ran across was the idea that a lot of African American students go to historically black colleges, and some people recommend that so they will not be distracted by racial tensions and that kind of thing, which exists obviously on all campuses, but on, say, in a white institution. What about that particular point? Because some people make that argument. Go to a historically black college, get your education, don't be distracted by all the rest of the stuff, because when you get out, you'll have to deal with it anyway. What do you say to somebody? Or is that a legitimate argument?
You know, I would say no.
Okay.
You know, students are going to face various distractions regardless of what institution they go to. Whether it's the University of Michigan, whether it's UMES, Salisbury, it makes no, you know, difference. I think that what is important is the culture at the institution that helps students move through whatever challenges they are facing or that they will face. And so, it is my hope that regardless of where a student goes to school, if they are facing those particular challenges, that the institution is adequately addressing those students' needs. And that is not to say that racism is not intra. Okay, so there is no magic potion that says that African Americans don't suffer from racism from other African Americans, that white students don't suffer racism from other white students. I think that you have some ongoing myths that we have to continue to challenge about higher education. For instance, why would a white student self-select to go to a African-American institution? Is it that they somehow were not good enough to get into a Stanford or a College Park or some other, you know, myth? You know, I would say that that is not the case. I say that students are attracted to the quality of education regardless of where it is. In North Carolina, Mike Easley, who is the former governor of North Carolina, earned his law degree from North Carolina Central University, one of several HBIs in that state. North Carolina Central University has a higher passing of the bar rate on the first time than both Duke and Carolina. So after Mike Easley attended law school there, other people started paying closer attention to NCCU's law school. And now it is extremely diverse because students understand that I can get an equal, if not better, quality of education here than I can anywhere else. And so those are the type of things that I think we need to continue to focus on within higher education. It's the quality of education across the board that we collectively prepare our students to succeed in a global society.
I want to turn to there's a financial end of this, because one of the things I was looking at, a number of institutions, African-American institutions, were struggling with finances. And just the stats alone, I mean, in just private universities, you've got something like, in terms of their endowment, $223 million on average, right? Mm-hmm. For private, historically black colleges, it's only $38
million. Right.
Public universities, $87 million for endowment. Public HBCs, that's only $49 million. Are you facing issues when it comes to finances and contributions into your system? And secondly, what kind of strategies, if there are any, that are needed to increase that ability to raise the funds to meet today's challenge?
Okay. Yeah, I will tell you from a financial fiscal standpoint, UMES is on solid footing. I can't intellectually speak about other HBCUs,
sure,
you know, overall. I will tell you that we have, I think, a very aggressive and a very successful institutional advancement office. A few years ago, we brought in, through our capital campaign program, over $15 million, which exceeded our goal, which when you look at the scope of HBIs, that is a tremendous amount of money. Now, that's going to pale in comparison to some other institutions such as, College Park, 30,000 students. You go out to UC Berkeley and so on and so forth. But I think for where we are and the size of our institution, I think that was a very significant goal and accomplishment that we, you know, had. I think that our students do continue to struggle financially. HBIs were impacted heavily with changes in the Parent PLUS loan here last year. But students across higher education are struggling. But it is more significant with African-American students at HBIs. We have a larger number of students that are Pell eligible, and a larger number of students that receive and depend on financial aid. A large number of students who are first generation at UMES, that fluctuates annually between 50 and 55%. Those students are coming from single parent homes or two parent homes that are struggling to make ends meet. And so when you then add on the actual cost of financing higher education, it becomes a very significant challenge. But Dot, to put this into another perspective, at UMES, we have worked diligently to keep education affordable. That's a part of our overall mission, is access. And our land grant mission really fosters our creating opportunities for education to the common man. So when you look at those factors and you take into account some of the financial issues that our students come to us with, we've been fighting to keep our tuition costs low. We are one of the lowest in the system here in the state of Maryland. And yet, what it costs for a student to go to UMES in a year, it costs more to put a child in daycare for that same year in the United States of America. So when you look at it from that perspective, higher education costs are going up, not at the rate of private institutions when you look at public institutions, but we are working to make sure our students' educational process and goals are not derailed because of high costs.
So do you see any efforts to change your approach or come in with new strategies, maybe that's a better way to look at it, in terms of meeting the kinds of demands of the 21st century? Because it's certainly much different than even when I went to school, and certainly when went to school. Do you see new strategy coming out? Because, I mean, some people have said some of the institutions have talked about actually cutting back some of their programs, and that there's maybe emphasis on studying abroad or maybe more aggressive recruiting. What kinds of within the next minute, what kind of strategies do you see you guys using?
Well, I think that you touched on some. When you look at how can we broaden our footprint and expand educational opportunities to more students, I think we have to look at things like online courses. We have to look at how we continue to hold costs or drive costs down. We have to look at how we can stay more innovative, bring in more research dollars. I mean, at UMES, when you look at the actual USM system, as far as research dollars coming in, we are fifth out of all of the schools in the actual Maryland system. So we have to continue to use those innovative ways to deliver education in a more cheaper fashion, and understand that we're going to be challenged moving forward, as every institution will be. Out in California, they have cut classes and academic programs because of financial issues. We've not had to do that as of just yet. Florida is struggling, the state of Louisiana. All of these areas are struggling across the board. UMES is not immune to that, but we will continue to find innovative ways to make education a top priority for our students now and tomorrow.
We've been speaking with Dr. Anthony Jenkins. He's the Vice President of Student Affairs and Enrollment Management at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, talking about the role of historically black colleges and universities in the 21st century, and we appreciate you stopping by.
I appreciate you all having me. Thank you.
And we'll take a break, and up next, we will take a look at a major literary figure in the African-American community. This morning, we are going to explore the life and times of Zora Neale Hurston. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Hurston was born in 1891 and rose to prominence as a novelist in the 1930s and 40s. But unlike many black writers of her generation, she wrote about life in rural America, specifically a town called Eatonville, Florida. In 1937, she wrote what has become perhaps her most famous novel, Her Eyes Were Watching God. In studio to take a look at Hurston's work and significance, we have Clara Small, a former emeritus professor of history at Salisbury University, and she's made a study of Hurston as well as also has the production of a one-woman show featuring the famous novelist as well. Maybe we'll ask you for a little bit of that later on, but welcome to the program.
Great. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let me first of all, I want to go back to sort of the backdrop for Hurston, because At the time that she's beginning to write, you've got a whole generation of writers, including Richard Wright, and you've got a series of changes that are taking place in which you've got things like an Uplift program, which began to try to mold the image of African Americans in a different light for white Americans. You've had the New Negro Writers Renaissance, and then she comes along and she's different than those other writers who are really basically writing about the city, the interrelationship between whites and blacks, the oppression, but she takes a different approach. Explain a little bit about that background, the milieu in which she's writing.
She's writing from her experience of growing up in an all-black town. She's also writing from the experience of sexism, understanding that women were generally supposed to be submissive to all men. And we also know that that was a time when men thought that women should not be in any leadership position. And she takes a different tack. Even more so, she was a trained anthropologist. She studied under Franz Boas at Barnard College in New York. And then she went out on her own. So she's writing from her experience, and she traveled extensively. So this is a different type of environment for her. Even more so, she had a patron. And she paid her, gave her money the same as men. Men at that time, even black writers thought that women should not be paid the same as men. She had a car, she had a gun, she traveled by herself. I mean, can you imagine a woman just getting in a car at that time, traveling across country? And she said what she thought and believed in. And she also used dialect in a different way. And instead of writing about individuals of the middle class or upper class, she wrote about migrant workers. She wrote about individuals that you would not have read about at any other point in time. So she is quite different.
And there's this conflict that comes up. As a matter of fact, she was criticized by people like Wright and others because she used this dialect, because they thought that this was fitting into a stereotype, particularly at a time which white racism particularly was reaching a rise with the Klan, particularly in the 1920s,
yes,
and The Birth of a Nation, which also became very
Thomas
popular.
Thomas Dixon, yes.
And President Woodrow Wilson segregated the army. I mean, she was doing this at a time in which they said, we want to push back, we don't want this. How does they explain that conflict between those two?
Well, which was a strange situation because there were some black writers who were also using dialect, Paul Laurence Dunbar and others. But because she, as a female, was writing in that vein, they disagreed with her. And she had no problem telling them that she didn't approve of the way that they were writing and how they perceived her. This is a new woman. This is a woman who's expressing things quite differently than most other women writers during that time. And men did not really accept that. And she was very vocal about it.
So I understand. Well, let's still go back a little to her biography. So where was she born? And I understand that she sort of decides, she turns around and tells everybody she was born in Eatonville, Florida.
No,
which
she
of
was actually
she
born in
right.
Alabama.
Exactly.
And the family moved to Eatonville.
Yeah.
And her father, I believe, was mayor for about three times. So she understood about uplift. She understood about self-determination. And she was determined to do what she could for herself. She didn't accept the position of being a housewife or being submissive to men. And her mother always told her, jump for the sun. In other words, rise to the top no matter what.
And so how does she move then from the small little town in Florida to going to college, which she did, Morgan State, then Howard? And how did that blossom?
Well, her mother died.
Right.
Her father was a preacher. He married again to a very young lady, and they disagreed, and they got into a fight. And she, according to how she writes in her biography, and then she leaves to live with relatives. From relatives, she went to live with her brother, and she wanted to go to school, but they wanted her to take care of the other kids. She decided not to. She got jobs. She even had a job with a troupe, a musical troupe, traveling everywhere. And then she ended up in Baltimore. And she went to the preparatory school that now became a part of Morgan State University. And she had the opportunity to read books. And that is what propelled her to simply say, okay, I've got to do something for me. She ended up in New York. And she went to school, got a scholarship to go to school. And that's how she became a trained anthropologist, a novelist, someone who wanted to do what she wanted to do.
Yeah, she spent a lot of time writing even before she got into writing novels.
Oh, yes. Short stories, articles that happened to be published by the Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History and by many individuals and many newspapers. So she was well known, but she was also her own person, which was quite different for most women during that time.
Now, you mentioned that she was an anthropologist. She visited the Caribbean, did Central America. Tell me a little bit about that. Yeah, tell me a little bit about what she was searching for there.
She was studying voodoo and everything else. And in order to study it, she had to take part in some rituals. And that became a conflict with her husband. As a matter of fact, she married twice. The first husband didn't get along. They didn't get along very well. The second husband, I think they stayed married for a couple of months because she was away so much and she was studying voodoo. He may have become afraid that she might practice that on him. There's no proof of that, but there's a little story that goes along with it.
What is that story?
That she was so involved in voodoo at that time that he became afraid of her. So that might help to explain her short marriage.
Mm-hmm. What did she do? What do you think she took away from her travels there in Latin America?
Understanding different cultures, understanding how different people have different ideas, but it did not mean that it would automatically be racist or discriminatory. But people working together, getting past those differences. Mm-hmm. And so she was definitely, she put to work her training.
And how do you think that her anthropology then influenced her novel writing?
Oh, my goodness. Especially when their eyes were watching God. When she was studying migrant workers down in Florida and when the hurricane came in and she understood about different groups of people, but most of the people didn't. One of the ladies in her story mentions the lady who owned the restaurant, mm-hmm. and she looked down upon individuals who were a bit of a different hue than she was. And because Janie was supposedly light-skinned, and the man she was married to at that time, Tea Cakes, was darker, she thought that the lady in charge of the restaurant who owned it thought that she was too good for him. So that's a study in anthropology as well about the different skin colors of people. And she began to look at classes and how class made a difference and how the lady in charge of the restaurant tried to get her away from her husband. And she even brought down her brother so that Janie could associate with him. So it's about classism, racism, discrimination, and everything else you can possibly think of.
Mm. How would you describe her characters? I mean, because it seems my first introduction actually was to the set of was an anthology of short stories.
Yes.
And one of the things I thought that was really remarkable was that these are stories obviously much different than say Richard Wright and Native Son. These are stories about individuals just
ordinary
living their
people.
Lives. Yeah.
Ordinary people. She was not necessarily concerned with writing about the upper class or middle class. She was concerned with life, ordinary people. And On the Muck, it's about ordinary people, migrant workers, why they move from place to place, trying to survive. It was not about showing how much they could acquire because they were from the lower class. They were not highly educated. They were simply trying to survive. Also using dialect.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Which gets at a certain point, you try to get used to it.
Yes.
And finally, you sort of how do you contrast? Let me ask you this: I'm talking about dialect. How do you contrast her use of dialect as opposed to, say, somebody like Mark Twain?
Oh my goodness.
Or do you have any thoughts? I just occurred to me, so I.
Well, Mark Twain in the Midwest, dialect is a little bit different. Dialect in the South means different things to different people. It's regional.
Right.
Even Smith Island here.
Yes, there are.
It's quite different. What it is cultural as opposed to classism, okay, in many respects. Because when you're using dialect, everybody in the area is basically using dialect, unless you are someone who comes there later. And that's when you're made aware of it, if you're not from there. Because if you use dialect, it simply means that everybody there understands what the terms mean. So it's quite different, quite different. In the Midwest, I lived in the Midwest. I lived in Missouri for 4 years. So I understand about dialect and how different. As a Southerner, I'm from North Carolina.
Okay.
In Missouri, they had to get used to me, and I had to get used to their dialect. And coming here, everyone says, oh, you are a Southerner. Yes, I am. But it's not that different because I've lived in different parts of the country, in New York as well. So that means that I have my speech is a combination of different dialects. You take on the attitudes and customs and traditions of where you live.
Hmm. So, I mean, she writes predominantly, obviously, about
Florida,
and she particularly African American women and how they cope with what seems to me all these various different situations that they face. I mean, you have sort of three situations for Janie, for instance, and their eyes were watching God. Describe to me how she's doing that in terms of the kinds of subjects she's talking about and the different kinds of relationships, because there are different relationships, even within this book, different kinds of relationships between men and women in her books.
Discover is one, whereby Janie must discover herself. Maybe the first discovery was when she realized at the age of 6 that she was black, because she was around white children all the time. So race did not mean anything to her at that point in time. The same is true for young kids today. Most young kids don't understand about racism or color. They're friends. They go to school together. It's only as they begin to mature and that they understand about racism. And racism must be taught. The next discovery is similar to a pear tree. The leaves is budding. And she kisses a young boy, and her grandmother who raised her tells her that if you can do that, you must be protected. I must get you to a position where you can be protected. So the grandmother marries her to an older man who has 60 acres and a mule. Excuse me. And so she gets married to him. She doesn't love him. She doesn't really care for him, but he protects her. And the grandmother uses that as to protect her, marries her to protect her. But she realizes that, Janie realizes that that's not what she wants. So this other man comes and she goes with him. He talks about a different type of life for her. And then he simply relegates her to working in the store. He is the big mayor of the town. And so he tells her that she must act accordingly. But yet, when someone else notices her and her long hair, he tries to make her put her hair up. He tries to make her stay out of the conversations on the porch, and that she must learn certain things, even though she has no education. And when he dies, everybody thinks that she must remain in that role of being the wife of the former mayor. But Tea Cakes comes along, and she changes her form of dress. You see relative equality between them. She loves him, but when he becomes ill because he was bitten by a dog, he tries to kill her. She must kill him in order to save herself. So she changes again. She buries him with his favorite objects, his guitar. She does everything that she could possibly think of that he would want. And she goes back to her hometown. The town where, not her hometown, but the town where she was married to, the storekeeper and the mayor. And everybody wonders why she dressed that in that manner, in overalls, because she had fine clothing. And so she tells her friend to tell the story to them through her mouth. And she's happy because she has found love, true love. She is happy because she has found herself. So she goes through several changes.
In the book.
And growth. Yep.
And growth. In the opening of the book, Their Eyes Are Watching God, she opens with this difference between men and women. She writes, ships at a distance have every man's wish on board. For some, they come in with the tide. For others, they sail forward on the horizon, never out of sight, never landing until the watcher turns his eyes away in resignation, his dreams mocked to death by time. That is the life of men. Now, women forget all those things they don't want to remember and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth, and then they act, and they do things accordingly. Explain that passage.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it's such a
men
profound...
have desires. They want to be the best of everything, but women have to forget everything they don't want to remember, the bad things of life. But at the same time, they still have their dreams. They hold on to those dreams, and they will try to achieve those dreams any way they can. But it doesn't mean that if they don't reach that point, it doesn't mean that they've forgotten them. But everything is good and prosperous, they remember. But at the same time, in the back of their minds, they're still hoping, trying to achieve it. I do the same thing. I want to be a millionaire. But in education, but education is not right. The means to achieve it.
The other thing we're talking about, because this comes from actually the passage has come from the opening, is when when she returns. And the other striking passage about this, and it's just actually, this is all actually on the first page. When she's walking, she comes back into town, she's walking. And it reads in part, says, the people all saw her come down. It was sundown. Yes. The sun was gone, but she had left his footsteps in the sky. It was the time for sitting on porches beside the road. It was the time to hear things and talk. These sitters had been tongueless, earless, eyeless, conveniences all day long. Mules and other brutes had occupied their skins. But now the sun and the boss man were gone, so the skins fell powerful and human. They became lords of sound and lesser things. They passed nations through their mouths. They sat in judgment. And this is about the people who are watching her and actually passing
watching
judgment.
Watching her coming back into town, yes.
And what's really striking, I thought, and I don't think it's made much reference to it later on in the book, but how this was a time they could occupy their own. The rest of the day, they were all out working for either somebody who was white or somebody, they didn't control their environment. But here at this moment, this was their time.
This was their time to discuss anything they could possibly think of. And sitting on porches, we call them lies now. But this was a means for men to discuss anything, to play the dozen, as we call it now,
right.
And to do whatever and make fun of each other. But this was a time for the men. Women were not a part of those discussions. The men talked about the women, but the women were not a part of it. There was a difference between men and women. And women were supposed to remain in the household to take care of their chores, but not be on the porch to hear the discussions. That caused one of the major problems with Janie and her second husband, because she wanted to take part in it. She wanted to learn how to play checkers or what have you. That was not permitted. So that sexism, that line of demarcation was there no matter what. And it was not until the Civil Rights Movement that women were considered to be equals of men in many respects, even though women were behind the scenes feeding the civil rights workers, giving them shelter, homes, places to live in, what have you. And even during the civil rights movement, women were supposed to just be secretaries until Ella Baker with SNCC. And many of the men who were a part of the civil rights movement reduced her funds because they thought she had become too powerful. Same thing for Shirley Chisholm. She was told, stay home and bake, you know, because she was not considered to be equal of the men. You hear of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Reverend Abernathy, Andrew Young, Jesse Jackson, and on and on and on. But generally, you hear only of Rosa Parks, but there were so many others, Mary Fair Burks and others, Mary Fair Burks, who actually started the women's movement down in Montgomery, Alabama. She had organized women over 10 years before the Montgomery bus boycott began. But then she lost her job teaching at the college. She came to Maryland and got a job at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And I have correspondence between Dr. Martin Luther King and Mary Fair Burks. And when he came here to speak, she introduced him. And when his wife came here to speak, she introduced him because she was a part of his church. So women have been relegated to second-class citizenship. She understood this very well. She understood it very well when she received funding that was from their patron that was equal to that of men, and the men did not like it.
So she becomes a famous novelist in the 1930s and 40s, and then her career just sort of declines. And at one point, she actually sends out manuscripts and things and gets rejected. What happened? What changed
that? Oh, numerous things. Well, one was the civil rights movement, and she wrote a letter criticizing the Brown versus Board of Education Topeka, Kansas decision of May 17, 1954. Separate but equal was destroyed on paper. She had even been accused of having an illicit affair with a 10-year-old. Well, she did not. She was out of the country at the time. And because her talents may have been just dying at that point in time, but she could not make a living, so she became a maid, cleaning houses and everything else. But maybe her time had passed, and maybe she did not have the passion that she had before. But other people were writing in a different vein, and because she criticized the Brown decision, and most blacks during that time thought that was not what you should do, because everybody thought it was one of the most important decisions that had been made during that time.
Well, why did she criticize it? Why did she didn't think it was a good idea?
From what I've read about that part, if I remember correctly, she thought that it would not have brought about any changes. It's the idea that you can pass legislation, but you cannot legislate minds of people, heart and minds of people. And she had seen certain things happening, but she did not see that much progress being made in terms of race relations because of non-support of decisions from the executive branch of the government.
I also understand she was also somewhat concerned, flowing out of that decision, of just what would happen to African-American institutions, educational institutions as well.
Because she thought that those schools would go out of existence. Teachers and principals and others would lose their jobs. And they did. And many schools came into existence solely to make sure that blacks did not go to schools with whites. I know a school in North Carolina that was formed solely for that purpose. I went to it from second grade to the 12th. And we did not have all of the facilities we were supposed to have because we had a school, and that's what the Board of Ed said. And so in order to get the facilities that we needed, we had to have rallies and contests every year to get the curtains for the gym and everything else you could possibly think of. So it became a problem. So she saw that, and many teachers as well as principals lost their jobs. Many schools were closed. So she foresaw that. And she saw that as a major, major problem for institutions that have been in existence for a very, very long time.
Now, you do a one-woman show, or at least you have in the past. Can you give us a little Zora Neale Hurston here? I guess, just a taste of it.
Oh, my gosh. Oh.
Just sort of start somewhere.
In their eyes were watching God. Zora Neale talks about the conflict between herself and her stepmother. She began to fight her because she had never been beaten by her father. And this woman, who was just a little bit older than she was, decided to fight her. So Zora Neale decided she was going to make sure that she won. And her father stood aside because he did not want to be a part of it. And the stepmother beat her sister. Zora Neale said, "I'm going to win." She called her a little skank and everything else. So Zora Neale was a woman who was determined, truly determined to win no matter what. And she knew at that point she had to leave home. But when I do it, I put myself in the position of Zora Neale.
So she kind of like disappeared as an author in contemporary writing, and then she sort of makes somewhat of a comeback with, I think it was the 1970s, I think it was Alice Walker.
Yes.
Who went in search
of her grave. Yes.
Yes. And what do you attribute her reemergence as a popular writer? I mean, I can go to a Barnes and Noble bookstore and there's her, and there's her books.
Because individuals such as Alice Walker and others, other writers, began to recognize just how powerful her writings were. And as a result, they began to republish her books. They began to perform her works. And then later, they were able to put into motion pictures. Their eyes were watching God with Halle Berry. Who else could you get to portray Janie? What better actress? And so individuals began to look at her writings again, and they began to put out these books by her family, Speak So You Can Speak Again, The Life of Zora Neale Hurston. So people began to look at her again and say, oh, this woman was talking about sexism. She was talking about classism. She was looking at migrant workers, things that most people did not bother to pay attention to before. She was ahead of her time. She was really ahead of her time. And she kept her name. Most women did not do that during that time. They took their surname of their husbands. Zora Neale kept hers.
What do you think she would make of what's happened today, Barack Obama's president, and all the changes that have occurred? Very difficult, obviously, because she lived in a much different time. But she couldn't see over the horizon. Most of us could not imagine in 1960 that in 2008 an African-American would be elected president. I mean, it just... beyond the scope. What do you think she would have thought, though?
As an anthropologist, I don't think that she would have had a problem with it.
Yeah.
Because she studied different cultures. She studied life. And because she went to so many different places and she looked at so many different groups of people, I don't think she would have had a problem with it.
Do you think she would have been surprised?
A little bit because of the period that she lived in.
Yeah.
But she also remembered the man who helped to deliver her.
Mm-hmm.
He had no problem delivering her. Her mother was there alone. And so he just, this man just was coming by to deliver food and meat and vegetables. And so I don't think she would have had a problem with it.
What about, I know she was a critic of things like what I think this potentially was affirmative action. We mentioned that she was critical of Brown versus Board. And she was also very concerned about government assistance to people in general, which was actually something FDR actually himself had expressed. But But now we have this whole infrastructure, and certainly African-American community is very supportive of government intervention, very supportive of that effort. Do you think she might have been at odds, or would she have accepted it?
She would have accepted part of it, but I don't think that she would have accepted all of it, because this was a person who was concerned with self-determination. This was an individual who was determined to make her own way, despite what others said and despite limitations at that point in time. She was determined to make her way. So she may have agreed with part of it, but not all of it. She would have said, no, get out and do what you can. This was a, in a way, self-made woman. Her family basically did not help her. She was willing to work whatever job she could in order to survive. She was a manicurist. She worked in a salon. But when she was working in that salon and as a manicurist, the thing was, she saw that they were catering primarily to whites, but not blacks. Blacks were working there, but blacks could not be catered to there. So she saw that divide, and she saw what was happening in D.C. at the time. So she was a self-made person. So she would have encouraged individuals to do what they could on their own. Even though there may have been government assistance, she said, no, you have to put forth some effort too.
We've been speaking with Clara Small. She is a former emeritus professor of history at Salisbury University, has made a study, I think to say the least, of Hurston's work, which has received a lot of acclaim, has really become a much more important book than probably a lot of people would have thought in the 1960s, for example, and probably much more appreciated now. And I appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, DelmarvaPublicRadio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.